Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another great episode. We have here Suspense Radio. We're back. Again, the schedule is going to be a little bit odd coming up in the next couple months, so make sure you check out suspensemagazine.com, click on the radio button, and see the schedule of everything that's coming up. We got some exciting announcing news that we will share with you just a little bit later about a guest that's going to be on the show a little bit later in the year. But right now, today's show, we have three outstanding offers for you. Coming up first is going to be James Tabor. He's going to be talking about his book, Frozen Solid. Next, we're going to have superstar author David Morrell, and then we're going to hand it off with Hank Steinberg. And you're like, who's Hank Steinberg? Well, if you watch the show Without a Trace, he is the show's creator, and he came out with a debut book called Out of Range. So everything here, 90 Minutes of Suspense Radio, starts right now. We are going to kick it off with our first guest. He is the author of the book called Frozen Solid. His name is James Tabor. James, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks very much for having me. This is a great opportunity. I appreciate it very much.
Hey, well, you know, we were supposed to have you on there a little bit previous show. Something happened. No big deal. We got you back. It's great that we were able to catch up with you because, you know, author schedules are always hectic and always crazy. And so it's good that you're able to spend here a half hour with us to talk about your book, Frozen Solid. Came out in March. And tell us a little bit about the book that might not be on the back cover to get people to get a little understanding of exactly what you got going on here.
Sure, you bet. Well, one of the things I like to do in my novels, these thriller novels, is to set them in extreme environments, extreme settings that lots of readers might not have gone to on their own. I've been to a lot of wild places in my own career, you know, technical diving and mountain climbing and hang gliding and other kinds of things. And so after the first book, which was set deep in the Mexican super cave, I thought, okay, what's another good place to go that's extreme and mysterious and just kind of strange? And, well, the South Pole kind of came up as I was doing a mental search. And beyond that, the Amundsen Scott Research Station at the South Pole, which is, it's almost like a space station because it's eight months out of the year, it's completely enclosed, sealed off, and isolated from the rest of the world. So, okay, that's a great setting for the thing. And then, what can happen? Well, in my research, I came across a very mysterious death that had happened in the South Pole in 2002 or 2003, I think. A very well-regarded scientist was found actually dead of some kind of poisoning. It was a very mysterious death. It was never adequately investigated, and I thought, gosh, you know, what would it be like to be down there and have something like that actually happen? And then my main character is a CDC microbiologist named Hallie Leland. So I thought, well, Hallie needs to go to the South Pole and have some extraordinarily mysterious and traumatic event happen once she's down there. And that really was the genesis of the book. And I put her down there, and then one thing led to another, and pretty soon she was embroiled in a worldwide conspiracy to, well, I don't want to give away too much here with spoilers, but that's kind of the genesis of the book. So it has an extreme setting, it has an extraordinarily adventurous and capable heroine, and it has a plot line that I like to put in my plots, things that are plausible science and that could constitute threats, reasonable threats to the planet. So you've got those three ingredients, and there you go. There comes the frozen solid novel.
Yeah, I mean, it's always fascinating. I guess the one thing that I always think about, like whenever I think about like the frozen tundra and the South Pole and the Antarctic and those stations, not only is just isolation, but of course the movie Thing always comes to mind for me, because, you know, that's always like one of the greatest things is, you know, when you're down there, to just to, the emotion that you kind of have to put with your characters of that feeling of like isolation, because you're talking, there really is nothing there. How kind of were you able to kind of capture that mentally with characters to understand, hey, this is much different than running around the streets of Chicago and New York chasing after something or even something supernatural. You're with nobody.
Yeah, you know, a couple of things I can say about that. One of them is I had not been to the South Pole. I'll say that up front, because it's very, very difficult, almost impossible to get to the South Pole as a civilian these days. In fact, accommodations and supplies are so restricted that when these guys and gals come through crossing the Antarctic continent, and they happen to cross the South Pole area there, they can't even come inside. They have to camp outside in tents. You know, that's how limited the resources and accommodations are. So that said, I have been in very, very cold, in very unforgiving Alaskan conditions, for example, on Mount McKinley, where, you know, it was 40 degrees below zero and the wind was blowing 60, 70 miles an hour for extended periods, and isolated with just me and a partner. So I had that kind of personal experience, and then I was able to do a tremendous amount of research, both through Skype interviews and polies. By the way, people who work down there are called polies, so no disrespect. Yeah. That's what they call themselves. information from them, blogs, video logs, all kinds of stuff, and that was extremely helpful to glean from the imaginations of people who had actually, you know, suffered that kind of environment. I will say, you know, you mentioned the movie The Thing, and the two of my favorite movies. People down there kind of create rituals around those movies. So every once in a while, they have these gigantic sort of orgiastic is too strong a word, but huge parties called Thing Nights, where people dress up and they kind of celebrate the weirdness of the place. And that goes into the book, and it's one of the integral events of the book, I should say. So anyway, that's to answer that question, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, that's always, you know, very because when you're dealing, like, you know, a lot with suspense and a lot of kind of elements, and you're bringing in the outdoor elements along with everything else, you definitely have to be, I mean, your book is definitely have to be a lot more complex. And so when you were thinking about, like, the character, what made you decide that Hallie would be the one that you felt that this would be the perfect person to kind of be the face of the book?
You know, I wanted somebody who had an affiliation with science, because in biomedical, or I guess you would say, you know, yeah, biomedical thrillers, I guess, is as good a label for the books I'm writing as any. I think that those protagonists, at least the protagonists that I wanted to write about, had to be familiar with a certain kind of science. And I, myself, especially since 2001, have found bioterror and germ warfare and those kinds of, I just found that absolutely fascinating, and always did, really. I think the greatest, you know, cornerstone book in the genre is Michael Crichton's Andromeda Strain, which is, you know, just a masterpiece, I thought. So I knew that my character needed to be a woman, which a lot of people say, well, you're a 60-whatever-year-old guy, you know, how can you write from the point of view of a woman? And I jokingly tell audiences, well, it's easier if you've been married three times. So that's my
yeah,
you know, my last
that'll
line.
Do it.
But in fact, I was an only child. My dad died when I was really young, and I was raised by my mother and her six aunts. So it's a completely matriarchal society. And I just grew up being very careful, very comfortable with women and the female persona. So it just kind of came maybe even more naturally to me than writing from a male persona. So she had to be a woman. She had to be a scientist. And I've loved, you know, various kinds of outdoor adventures my whole life. My first writing assignment, gosh, for the Washington Post, this is going back a long way, was to learn how to become a hang glider pilot and fly hang gliders and write about it. So I did that. And after that, I made a pretty good career writing nonfiction about adventure kinds of stuff. So the setting, the character, this all kind of evolved out of my, you know, my own experience throughout my life there. And so I'm going to continue writing these novels and keep putting her in, you know, extreme, odd, sometimes violent, always mysterious circumstances. Because I think that really adds, when you can make the setting a character in the book, like James Dickey did, for example, with the Cahoolawasi River, or some other examples come to mind, but I'll just cite that one. And then I think you've given a really extra level of energy and dimension to the novel. So that's why I'll keep putting her in those kinds of crazy places.
And you know, one thing that you mentioned that is one of my goals, like I guess you want to say bucket list, is to climb Mount McKinley, or, you know, I mean, at least to get somewhere on the vicinity of the mountain to do this. How you kind of talked a little bit about it in a fictional, you know, part of your work back on Forever on the Mountain. And I'm sure you put some of your real life things maybe into the book. How was that experience, though, personally?
I would say physically and emotionally, it's probably the hardest thing I've ever done. And that's saying quite a lot, because for a number of years I was a policeman in Washington, D.C., when it was the murder capital of the United States.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of crazy stuff. But McKinley is much more of a mountain than I think many, many people, even seasoned mountaineers, understand. And it's that way partly because it's so close to the Arctic Circle. So even though it's like 20,320 feet high, the atmosphere near the poles is much thinner. And that makes the actual altitude of the feeling of it to the human body more like 23 or 24,000 feet. So the altitude is much worse than you would think. And it's about, oh my gosh, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's, Everest, for example, is much closer to the equator. So McKinley, being up closer to the North Pole, the weather there is so severe that one guy who had mountaineered on Everest and McKinley said, gosh, you know, Everest was tropical by comparison. So all of which is just to say,
wow,
it's an extraordinary challenge. My climbing partner, when I was on McKinley, had not too long before come back from an expedition with a New Zealand team that had got to 27.5 on Everest. He and I were climbing as a two-man team. We got to about 16.5 on McKinley, and that was it. You know, we got caught in this hellacious storm. We had to hunker down for a little more than a week, ran out of supplies, and kind of went back to base camp with our tails between our legs. And the camp manager at that point, a wonderful woman named Frances Randall, said, well, boys, welcome back. Looks like you just stubbed your toe on the mountain there. And that was,
yeah, I mean,
that was not a spark.
Yeah, because that was,
it was,
and they say that only about half the people ever make the summit of McKinley that try it.
Yeah, that's true. And most of those actually make it on what's called the trade route, or the quote, easiest unquote route, the West Buttress route. But, you know, a combination of the environment, the weather, the altitude, and those two things just make it so much more of a challenge than you typically would think it would. Nonetheless, It was one of the, you know, salient experiences of my life, certainly my climbing career, and kind of prepared me to go back. I went back 3 or 4 years later, and with another rope team, climbed and summited another great mountain called Sanford in the Wrangell St. Elias Wilderness, and we climbed that mountain and performed a ski descent of it. So those experiences were able to help me really inform writing about the South Pole in terms of extended isolation, extreme cold temperatures, high wind, and maybe most importantly, the way people behave and perform under extreme, you know, extreme levels of stress. I think that was as valuable a thing, a lesson as any that came out of that, because you get under stress and people just start to do, they behave in ways that they normally would not. Let me just put it that way.
Right. And again, I want to remind everybody here, we're speaking with author James Tabor, jamesmtabor.com, T-A-B-O-R.com is his website. And the book is Frozen Solid, and that came out in March 2013, so it's out right now wherever you can buy books. But the other thing, too, is when people go to your site, you know, for readers that are just, you know, finding out about who you are, The one thing that you always notice is kind of, you know, like your previous book, which is The Deep Zone, which has the same kind of, you know, look and feel as The Frozen Solid. Is this kind of the genre that you think that you're going to kind of be staying in? Because The Deep Zone, you know, is about, you know, more of the, kind of more of the same. It's like more of the outdoors. It's more of the, you know, the strain, the stress of everything else that's going on, but, you know, with the story wrapped up in between. Is this kind of the genre that you feel comfortable in? Is there some things that, you know, you want to explore outside? You know, what do you kind of have looking forward into your future writing that you think, you know, how you're going to kind of progress it?
Sure. I like this genre a lot, and for several reasons, not the least of which is that my editor and publisher at Random House felt that it was a good genre for me to write in. So I'm working on the third book in the series now, which we don't have quite yet a title for. But hopefully we'll come out next March if I can get everything finished on time. I like this genre because it allows me to draw on a lot of the experiences I've had throughout my life in these, like I say, these extreme environments. You know, Hemingway said, write about what you know about. Well, I know about a lot of these strange places and can kind of bring that verisimilitude to the writing. I also like the character. You know, I like, there's a lot of my past and a lot of wonderful people that I knew who have been put into Hallie Leland. And so in a way, writing about her is being able to, like, go back and sit down and be with those wonderful people again. So that's a great, really rewarding experience for me. You know, sometimes writing is not fun. I gotta admit, mm-hmm. that. Like, stare at the blank computer and watch the blood drops form on your forehead. But when I sit down and write about Hallie, it is fun because I feel like I'm not a mystic, so I'm not channeling people, but I am in touch with those people who helped, you know, inform and create my own past. And so that makes it a rewarding experience. And I'd like to stay with her for quite some time. I've written all kinds of things. You know, I won a national award for short fiction. I've written award-winning nonfiction, but there's no freedom like you can find, I think, in writing novels and in writing pure fiction. And I really enjoy that now after a whole lifetime, really, of writing nonfiction. The freedom that you can have as a novelist is really refreshing. And I hope my publisher helps me, you know, stay with her and with this series for quite some time, because there's a lot of things. Gosh, there's just so many amazing things happening in technology and in biology and things like that that can just make for fascinating novels.
Yeah, and that's all, you know, it's almost like it's a new, I guess you want to say maybe like a new genre that's kind of being, you know, that you're kind of creating, because it's a little bit different. I mean, they put, you know, I mean, there might be thrillers that take people to an extreme location, but never set in the way that you've kind of done here with like Frozen Solid or The Deep Zone, where it's, you know, specifically geared to those different things. And so that kind of puts you more like at the forefront, and that's got to be a good feeling because you're kind of the one that's kind of, you know, starting off something a little bit different. And because it is, it's kind of its own little genre, right? It's something that's a little bit off of the tangents from the norm, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. And that's a reward, an observation that I find rewarding, because that from the outset, honestly, has been one of my goals. There's thousands of fine writers out there, you know, David Morrell and Lee Child and all those fellows, and I love reading their work. The challenge, I think, for a novelist is how do you make a unique character and a unique set of actions for your own work rather than just reinventing the wheel. And so from the outset, that was something I was hoping I would be able to do. And it seems like readers, it's really interesting, it seems like readers are responding. Even people who don't like caves, you know, for example, who are very like claustrophobic, they write to me and they say about the Deep Zone, gosh, you know, that was horrible, but hey, I really loved it. It scared the heck out of me. God, I love that. And many of them are saying the same thing about Frozen Solid. I shivered when I read it. You know, I couldn't put it down. It was 3 a.m. I got an extra cover and I had to keep reading. So it seems to be resonating with readers. And that, golly, I mean, for an author, there's nothing more rewarding than that, quite frankly. So I hope I can keep, you know, working in this same niche and broadening it and keep taking Hallie to these. I will leak a little bit and say that the next one coming up in March is set in Tanzania, near a volcano that is the only one of its kind on Earth. This is true, actually. There is such a volcano in Tanzania which emits the kind of lava that is found no place else on Earth. So
really,
Hallie is, yes, it's all true. Hallie is there to investigate extremophile microorganisms that might be living in that lava, and then all kinds of weird stuff starts to happen once she gets there. But again, it's an environment that is extraordinarily hot, extraordinarily dry. There's all kinds of mystical overtones because it's also the place where mankind was born. She's not that far from Old Dubai Gorge, and you know, the place where the Leakeys and others have found our distant first ancestors. So there's all these wonderful layers of Maasai people, magic and mysticism, and just, you know, I think it's cool stuff. So we'll keep Hallie going in that niche as long as we can, believe me.
Well, now, the other thing when you're writing a series, and of course Hallie goes along with, and there's always, you know, the sidekicks that are kind of with her and the people that, you know, you kind of bring, you know, that she kind of brings with her. Who is one of those sidekick characters that when you started in the Deep Zone and now you're moving on to Frozen Solid that is starting to get more of a voice than you felt they would have when you first started writing the series, and you start thinking, you know what, I want to start exploring them further, and now they're starting to become a little bit bigger as the series goes on?
It's got to be Will Bowman. Will Bowman is he's almost a Jack Reacher character. He's 6'4", he's about 240 pounds. He has some kind of a special operations military background. We're not exactly sure what. And he works now for some entity that's very deep and very invisible with the intelligence community. And he came along on the extreme cave expedition in the Deep Zone, basically as the leader in the security element for that. Well, they struck up a relationship during that time, which continued. And so when we pick up the action in Frozen Solid, you know, they've now become lovers, and it's a very solid relationship, very rewarding for both of them. So one of the challenges about writing about a mysterious figure like Will Bowman, who has to, you know, he comes out of the realms of shadows, and it's a mistake, I think, to define him too sharply. But at the same time, he has to become real enough and fleshed out enough that characters can identify with him and can believe that somebody like Hallie would fall in love with the guy. So I'm working book by book to bring Will into sharper relief, to give him more exposure, more time with Hallie, and more exposure with the readers. And I think it sort of sums up to say about his character that in the cave at one point, he says, well, do you kill people? And he says, well, not very often, but yes, and only those who really need killing. And he's such an interesting personality that she can continue the relationship despite that, you know, despite knowing that that's part of his job. So Will Bowman is a continuing challenge. I'm going to keep working with him. And readers, by the way, love him. readers just love Will Bowman. They say, you know, bring more Will and deepen that relationship. So I'm going to. That's definitely going to happen.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that, you know, people remember a lot is, of course, they always know, the main character. But if you can take those side characters and make them to where you're starting to get a lot more email on those, then a writer has to know that they're doing their job correctly and keeping characters that are memorable because, you know, I've said 1,000 times, the one thing you never want to do is write a character that's forgettable and people are like, yeah, who was that one character? Oh, yeah, it was that. Because then you didn't really connect with them emotionally, whether it was positive or negative.
Yeah, you're so right. You know, another great idol writer of mine is James Lee Burke, who has written the Dave Robichaux series. And Dave Robichaux, the protagonist, has this wonderful, wonderful sidekick. His name is Cletus Purcell, a defrocked New Orleans Police Department detective. And Cleet is just a bundle of contradictions. He's fat, but he's incredibly strong. He's good-hearted, but he's a vicious drunk. He's got all these wonderful contradictions. And yet, he's in every book. You like him, and he's totally, totally unforgettable. And you're absolutely right. That's a brilliant observation. If you create a character that people can't forget, then you've done a darn good job as an author. And I'm still working on that with Will, quite frankly. I'm trying to find the balance between showing enough of him that he continues to be intriguing without giving too much of him away so that he becomes too well known, if you understand what I mean there.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Jace, you keep writing solid books and there'll be no question about having to deal with those characters because people will remember them for a very long time. And we want to thank you so much for coming on to speak about Frozen Solid, a little bit about the Deep Zone, some of your future things. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I want to, you know, hopefully if you're at Thriller Fest, we'll catch up with you.
I will look for you. I will definitely be there. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate this.
All right. You have a good day, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author James Tabor, and the book is Frozen Solid. JamesMTabor.com is the website to find out a lot more information on stuff that he is working on along with his book and everything else that he has going on. Another guy that I want you to talk about here is, his name is Amon Kavacic, and he's done something remarkable where it's called Blood on the Stage. It's the fourth in a series, and what he has going on is that the book is a finalist in the category of nonfiction for the Independent Publisher Award, the Benjamin Franklin Award, the Forward Borg of the Year Awards. So he's got a lot of stuff that he's got going on, and we've had him on. So you definitely want to check out everything that he's doing with his book called Blood on the Stage, 1975 through 2000, and check out what he's going on. And you know, he brings all those great plays and everything to life, and that's something that you want to look at. We were going to be back here with our next guest, author David Morrell, to talk about Murder as a Fine Art, his latest book. It just came out in May, so hang on for that, and we'll be right back at you. So again, everybody, I welcome you all back. I want to thank James Tabor for being on the show, and we are jumping right in here to our next guest, master thriller writer David Morrell, force creator of Rambo, did something very unique with his last book, The Naked Edge, is back here with his latest, Murder as a Fine Art, taking the reader back into 1800s London with quite a tale of intrigue and history all wrapped into one. So, David, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's always fun to visit. And, of course, Suspense Magazine is one of the great avenues for people to read about suspense and thrillers.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, we've tried our best here in the last, God, it's been 6 years now to just try to keep the ball rolling and keep more
it's
and more
amazing.
People coming to the great genre.
I remember talking to you when you started. We were at Thriller Fest, as I recall, the International Thriller Writers Conference. And I remember when you were first starting. And in a certain way, you know, I feel almost proprietorial in the sense that, you know, I was kind of tangentially, you know, I think I had something in the first issue. I can't remember. But, you know, I'm real thrilled about the way everything has gone.
Yeah, that was 4 years ago already when we first talked. Because this will be our third Thriller Fest coming up here in July, and we missed last year's for reasons, and so 4 years, it's been amazing. And you, and then, like we said, you did something very unique with your last book, The Naked Edge, and but now you got Murder as a Fine Art, taking the reader back into 1800s London and England and around. So can you give us a little bit about what might not be on the back cover, and you know, the thoughts behind the book and some insight into it?
Well, let's start with the idea that this is my 41st year as a published author, and my books have all had action and suspense, but I was trained to think in a long, long road, not, you know, 5 years, but 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, that a career was a long thing that you built upon, and that repetition was not the way to have a career. That, you know, you could write, you know, the same kind of book for 10 years, and then writers, you know, the writer gets tired about the same time the reader does. And so my goal was always to try to write thrillers that were, you know, advance the idea of what a thriller could be, that were, that would surprise people, that, you know, they wouldn't say, oh, I've seen this before, but, you know, they'd say, well, I've not seen anything like that before. That's pretty exciting. So, it's kind of amazing to me. I have a doctorate in American literature, and I was a professor of American literature. And 3 years ago, I felt an irresistible urge to become a Victorianist. And the reason I did it was I became obsessed with a man, an author of the period, the 1800s, roughly 1821 to 1859. Named Thomas de Quincey, whom I'll talk about I'll talk about in a second. But my memory was jogged because I was watching a movie about Charles Darwin and the nervous breakdown he suffered when he was writing On the Origin of Species. And what had happened is his favorite daughter had died, and at the same time his wife, who is a devout Christian, understood the way Origin of Species could be interpreted if you believed in the Bible literally. And she feared for his soul, and he began to fear that God had killed his daughter in order to have him stop writing the book. I mean, talk about drama, right? I mean, what burdens. And the poor guy, he had a nervous breakdown, and he was sick all the time, sick to his stomach, and boils and fevers, and he couldn't sleep, and basically he was a mess. And about two-thirds of the way through the movie's about how he overcame all this. And it's called Creation. It's a recent movie. I recommend it. It takes place roughly in 1855, which is important, because about two-thirds of the way through the movie, a guy shows up. He's got no other function except to be a message bearer. And he shows up, and he says, you know, Charles, some people like De Quincey are suggesting that we can be controlled by thoughts and emotions that we don't know we have. And I'm watching the movie, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, what did I just hear? because that sure sounds like Freud. You know, nobody could figure out why Darwin was sick all the time. He couldn't figure it out. But, you know, if you're in the modern era, you know that the guy was so torn by guilt that it was making him sick. But in that era, they didn't understand that. So I thought, gee, that's really interesting, because Freud didn't publish until the 1890s. So we're talking about
right.
half century later. And anyhow, I call it going down the Victorian rabbit hole, because I immediately went to books I have here. I still have my textbooks from college and below these many years, and I started reading about De Quincey again. And at the time, my English professors, you know, poo-pooed him as, you know, he was famous because he was the first person to write about drug addiction in a book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And, you know, so they just give him a footnote. But what I discovered was that because of his opium use, he had these epical nightmares. 100 years, he said, he lived each night. And he began to feel that dreams, nightmares, were a reflection of the personality having them, which was a whole new idea that Freud, you know, didn't get into until the 1890s. And I began thinking that this guy might be interesting in a novel. And then I found out that he inspired Edgar Allan Poe, the inventor of the detective mystery story. And
right.
Poe, in turn, inspired Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to create Sherlock Holmes. So I thought, there's a way to think of De Quincey as being at the start of the detective tradition, because he wrote about murders so often in his essays. And that was that. You know, the next thing I knew, it was almost like, this is, it's like a scene from a novel. It was almost like De Quincey had his soul had gone into me, that, you know, I was reincarnated or something. It was very weird, especially for a contemporary Americanist to suddenly be in the 1850s London.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like 6 degrees of separation. when you're, I mean, how they're all kind of innerly connected, and it's just amazing that you just happened to stumble across that Darwin movie that was just like, bam, there it is. And that's kind of what I always tell authors, keep your eyes and ears open, because there's stories everywhere around you if you're just paying attention.
Exactly. And I mean, actually, that's the very topic that I wanted to raise here is I teach writing at various conferences, including Thriller Fest, and I tell the students, look, if you're interested in something, ask yourself why you're interested in it, because that might be the key to understanding, you know, a subject you're desperate to write about, because it's something very personal to you. And I just seized on this. I wasn't looking. I had something else I was working on, but De Quincey just grabbed me so much. And I think what appealed to me was that it was a way to write mystery and suspense and action in a detective novel, which I had never written before. My books are straight thrillers, that, you know, a way to look at the mystery story, the mystery novel, in an entirely different way. And then that, of course, led into, I mean, let's get real, 1854 London. There's a reason why I had to pick that year. Well, what do I know about 1854 London? Fortunately, because of my graduate school experience, and I'm well known for my research, and I just had so much faith in this, I literally mm-hmm. spent 2 years researching the topic. And I have shelves and shelves of books about Victorian culture and London of the period. I reread De Quincey's thousands, literally thousands of pages of essays and of book reviews and fiction. I mean, he was very prolific, especially for being a drug addict. And then I read every Victorian novel of worth that was, you know, roughly related to the 1850s. With two goals in mind. One was to make readers believe that they are in 1854 London, which is a really hefty goal to try to manage.
Yep.
And the reviewers have said that I succeeded. All the reviewers have talked about how vivid it feels that they feel that they are there. And the other goal was to make format content. so that since I was writing about 1854 London, the book would feel as if it had been written in 1854, so that it is an imitation Victorian novel itself. So it's all very fancy and very exciting.
Yeah, because there's a couple authors that kind of go back to that Victorian era, and they have some detectives and things, and their biggest challenges is, I don't know if it was when you're writing about that, you have to leave all the technology away that you've been kind of working on, and all the modern weapons and all the modern things that they have going on now. Was that a difficult challenge to figure out how would a detective and how would they do in the Scotland Yard and act? Because this is 34 years even before Jack the Ripper, which was in 1888, came out.
That's correct.
So that was
exactly
even before all of that.
Well, yeah, and the London Police Department, actually the Metropolitan Police Department, they called it, was created in 1829, and then the detective branch was created in 1842, and they were, you know, working all of this out. And fortunately, my research, I found several books that are, you know, that detailed the early history of Scotland Yard and the methods they used. And I mean, you know, I found it surprising and delightfully so that, you know, they were experimenting with plaster casts in footprints, for example. So I was able to use that in the book and even give the recipe for it. And in addition, anybody who was arrested had a complete card file on that person, height, weight, eye color, scars, fake names, relatives, addresses, and even samples of handwriting if the person could write. And, you know, who would have thought that in 1854 it would be that, you know, in a certain way sophisticated. So that was real cool. The big advantage, and I've been talking about this in my writing classes, is that the cell phone has ruined narrative, because people just whip out their cell phones, and so we don't have face-to-face conversations, and we don't have, you know, the environment in which the conversation would occur. One could imagine a novel in which they're all cell phone conversations. And too often, writers don't make it clear that it's a cell phone conversation, so that when the conversations end and they click the button to discontinue the call, I'm startled because I thought it was a face-to-face deal, and then I go back to find out where the hell the cell phone conversation started, and by then the book's done for me. All this started with the X-Files when they were using cell phones so much, and I think it's really ruined narrative structure in the novel. And so not to have cell phones, I was just overjoyed. Not to have, you know, the best they had at the time was a telegraph. Very exciting to be able to, you know, re-envision how narrative could be.
Now, again, I want to remind everybody we're speaking here with author David Morrell. DavidMorrell.net is his website. The book, Murder as a Fine Art, is available now wherever you can find books. So when you're taking the reader back and you're starting them back in from 1811, working them up into 1854 with the whole stuff that's going on, what has the audience kind of come back, just the regular reader and not the reviews? What was the one thing that you see that they talk about over and over that kind of gave you a little shocking, that they were like, wow, you know, I didn't think that they would maybe focus on that part or this and that? And it gives you the idea of maybe writing into the future, kind of now you kind of understand what the reader is curious about in the Victorian age might be a little bit different what you were when you first started writing it.
Well, it's a good question, and I've been getting emails through my website from people who say that they've never written to an author before. I mean, it's really, really been cool to see this reaction. What I'm getting, first of all, is, wow, you really did make me believe I was in 1854 London. One of the things I like to point out is, how much did a woman's clothing weigh in 1854? Not a shop girl, but a middle or upper class person. And I have a lot of fun with this when I'm with an audience. I can really do it up big. But I, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, 10 pounds, thinking they're exaggerating. And I take them up through 15, 20, 25, 30, and they're looking at me with disbelief until I say, oh, the woman's clothes weighed 37 pounds. And so the next question is, how the hell can that be? And the answer is because they wore hoop skirts, hoop dresses that had either metal or whale teeth, which was what the hoops were made of, and they needed 10 yards of ruffled satin to cover that contraption. And because the hoops popped up so much, they then had to put in all these undergarments for modesty, and the hoops still popped up, so then they put lead weights in the things. So basically, these poor women were carrying around 37 pounds. And, you know, when I was able to get to that degree of intimate knowledge of the way people lived in 1854, that's when I knew I had control of the subject. And the other thing I'm getting, and this is, you know, just so gratifying, is we love Thomas De Quincey. He's one of the coolest guys around, you know, this 4'11" guy that drank 16 ounces of laudanum a day instead of killing
him.
But it made him, and we don't recommend this, but in this one case, it made him brilliant. And I mean, they just love De Quincey, and actually some of them are going and now and picking up his stuff in order to read it. And then the third thing, though, and this was, you know, my secret weapon in the book, is De Quincey had a 21-year-old daughter named Emily. And Emily was sort of his caretaker. He's 69 when the book occurs. Boy, that took a while. And she was basically taking care of him, and she, I don't have this in the book, but it's typical of her that there's a story in which he was writing and he was leaning over a candle and he set fire to his hair. And she said, "Father, your hair is on fire again." And he said, "Oh, thank you, dear," and then took a hand and then patted out the flames as he went on writing. And, you know, I mean, what a cool relationship, in a way, these two had. And Emily, you know, because she grew up with De Quincey, who knew everybody, who had stalked Wordsworth and become his friend, and you know, lent money to Coleridge so he could meet Wordsworth. And then after Wordsworth moved out of Dove Cottage, De Quincey moved into Dove Cottage up in the Lake District so he could live and eat and sleep where Wordsworth had. And you know, this guy had met so many really wonderful people, and Emily knew them. So she was a very cosmopolitan person, even though she was, you know, a street person because they were terribly poor. So anyway, the whole point being that she is a really, really interesting character that I didn't publicize when we were, you know, promoting the book. I just sort of figured, you know, people will find her if they want to, and everybody's in love with Emily, and I've been getting a lot of requests to do a second one.
And so when you get a request to do a second one, is that something that, you know, because I'm sure, because you always think a couple books ahead. These are, because like you said, it took 2 years for you to research. So is that something that you are considering into the future by maybe having Emily kind of as a higher character moving forward? Have you thought about that in the future?
I have. I'm about halfway through, actually, a sequel. I don't normally, as you know, I don't normally write sequels because it sort of goes against my theory that we have to move forward. But I'm really, really hooked on this guy, and I have, you know, so much about 1854, in this case now 1855 London, that I wanted to use it. I didn't have a chance. And in fact, you know, way back when I first wrote the book, my good friend Barbara Peters, who owns a Poison Pen bookstore in Scottsdale, and she read the book and she said, "Oh my God, this is a trilogy." And I, you know, this is the first I'd thought. I thought it was a one-off. So then, you know, when people said, and my publisher, Mulholland Books, kept saying, we want another one. So I'm, you know, I love the guy so much, Thomas De Quincey, that I'm more than happy to spend a little more time with him.
And, you know, and I mentioned before that your last book, The Naked Edge, you did something that was extremely different in books because it was an Amazon exclusive. They were the only ones you kind of had out the ebook form. Was there something why you decided not to go that route with Murder as a Fine Art like you did with The Naked Edge? Because you were such a pioneer with that book and how you published it.
There were a variety of circumstances that made me release The Naked Edge. I was one of, and perhaps the first, established author to release a completely original new novel as an ebook before it was in print. And there were a number of factors that brought that together. One was that my granddaughter had died in 2009, but she'd been sick. She had the same rare bone cancer that killed my son, and she had been sick since 2008, about the time that I had to make a decision about The Naked Edge, and which is a sequel to The Protector, oddly enough, talking about looking ahead and yet somehow doing sequels. I mean, you know, well, hey, be unpredictable, right?
Exactly.
I did not have the it is enormously energy and time consuming to release a printed book. There are so many, and I like it. You know, I'm certainly not complaining, but it is a fact that you have to be at the top of your energy. And I was just done. You know, reliving what had happened to my son. And now it's happening to my granddaughter, Natalie, and I thought, all right. At the same time, in 2009, when she died, the e-book revolution occurred. I mean, it's hard to imagine that all this happened within 4 years with e-books. And Amazon simultaneously came to my agent, Jane Distel, and said, you know, would David want to get on this e-book thing? And I thought, all right, if I'm ever going to do it, this is the time, because I just don't have the energy to go the traditional route with this book. I'm certainly not going to have the strength to tour. And I don't know if I have the strength to, everything that's involved. Believe it, the onus of marketing on authors has increased exponentially in the last 5 years. Many, many authors are spending 3 to 4 hours a day instead of writing, promoting themselves on the social media. And so anyway, to shorten the story, I said sure, and while we're doing it, why don't I release 9 of my backlist titles that I have ebook rights to as a 10-book package. And this made big news. It was on the front page of the Los Angeles Times, for example. There was a lot of attention, and hey, you know, attention is good. And it certainly boosted, you know, I got to thinking about ebooks, and I now, next week, all of my books in one fashion or another will be available as ebooks. I've been archiving and putting together the whole career, and also lots of short stories that were out of print, and lots of magazine articles, such as ones about John Wayne's westerns and Marilyn Monroe and Frank Sinatra, that had been in print, but nobody would ever find them. The magazines are long gone. So I did the e-books. That was then. The book Naked Edge came out in 2010. And it was around about that time that I started big time in I was feeling better, and I got into researching De Quincey. And there's something, I get emails and letters from people who say that my life was going to pieces, and they give these terrible tragic stories of my illness and divorce and fires and car accidents. It's just heartbreaking, and they say that I distracted them, and that's just a wonderful thing to hear. And in some ways, 1854 London, I don't like the era we live in. It's a disagreeable, rude, violent, profanity-laced era in which we live. And I was so happy to go back to a different time. Mind you, they had their own problems and the health issues and all that. But it was so happy to go back. And even if I was talking about, what we haven't addressed is the Ratcliffe Highway murders, the real-life murders that the book is based on, the first publicized mass murders in English history. Even with those terrible murders, I was able to distract myself from all the bad stuff that was happening in my life.
Well, I'll tell you, David, I mean, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, because your insight and just your emotion and how much of yourself you put into your work is why, of course, you are at the top, been at the top for many years. And that's why, your fans, I mean, everything that you put out is just, it's like the Midas touch. And we just enjoy it just so much.
It's about, I tell my students that the books they write should be written because they absolutely insist on being written because they make us fuller people and make us understand ourselves better. And that, you know, if somebody were to read my books from First Blood with Rambo on in chronological order, they would basically have the autobiography of my soul. That those books would reflect
yeah.
what was going on in my mind, in my emotions, in my life. Not that they're, you know, literal, but that this, the concerns would be the what was important to me at the time. And, you know, it's I have to say, you know, I was talking to my agents recently, and they said they're having a great deal of difficulty selling thrillers anymore, and that the market is softening, and that people... editors are saying, you know, this all feels alike. I think I know what they mean, because there's, in some cases, there's kind of an attempt to chase the market rather than to advance it. You know, and I had, when I wrote Murders of Fine Art, lots of people told me I was making a huge mistake. And, you know, it didn't matter to me, because this was a book I absolutely had to write. I just wanted people to go to 1854 London. You know, if the book, we must write the books that are not what we think we're going to make some money from. Truly, it's never been on my mind, but instead to write what matters to us, even if it means taking a risk and even potentially failing.
Right. I mean, and that's the biggest thing. You can't be afraid to fail if you want to
yes.
succeed. Yeah, that has to be in there, and that has to be one of your driving forces to go, is to do that. And I'll tell you what, you tell those agents that if they can't sell thrillers, they need to come to Suspense Publishing, because I'm keeping it alive, and that's why, you know, we have our publishing company that's doing it, because there's no way. It's the greatest genre out there.
I agree, but you see what's going on. You're willing to to take chances on stuff because the risk isn't so great. But, you know, if you're dealing with a mega corporation, and I fear that some publishers are chasing the market too, it's a very complicated thing. I know all kinds of gifted thriller writers, and many of them aren't getting published because the stuff is so different.
Yeah,
but
that's good.
Yeah, well, but that's why when I say that's good, that's why you exist.
Right. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure. We're going to see you in a little over a month at Thriller Fest, and, you know, we'll talk a little bit more off the air, too, just to see what's catching up. And we'd love to have you back on, and whenever you got to talk, let us know.
Okay. It's always good to sit down with you.
All right, David. You have a good day, and we'll talk with you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is Thriller Master author David Morrell with his book, Murder as a Fine Art. DavidMorrell.net is the website. You just hear from the interview the amount of work and the amount of emotion and the amount of research and just everything that he puts into one of his books. And it definitely shows when you're finished with it, because you gasp for air and you just don't want to stop. So we're going to be back here with our next guest. Like we said, it's Hank Steinberg. He is the creator of Without a Trace. He has a new novel out called Out of Range. And in the meantime, we want you to also know that Simon & Schuster has a book coming out, and you want to visit a place where trash mingles with trash and dead is waiting. Read West Palm by Josh Cordero. It's a four-part serialized ebook from Pocket Star. And again, you can download West Palm today. So go search for that and find out. And we're going to be right back here with Hank Steinberg, so hold on one second.
Hard times you have.
So welcome back, everybody, and we are glad that you are here to join us for our last segment. It's with creator of Without a Trace, the show that you've seen, I believe it was on CBS, and his name is Hank Steinberg, but he's jumped himself into a new realm. Like we've had another author, Nick Santora, who did his new book, and now we have Hank Steinberg coming out with Out of Range, coming out of the Hollywood into the novel scene. And we want to thank you so much for coming on today, Hank. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
So this is much different than writing, of course, for a TV show or movies or anything. You know, you're writing for a much different audience, and it's novel. Why did you decide now would be a great time that you throw your hat into the ring, and why was Out of Range the book that you wanted to kind of start yourself off with into this crazy-ass world of publishing?
I know, you know, I think ignorance is bliss in a way. So, you know, it started with the kernel of the actual idea for a story, and I didn't even know what the story was going to be or what form it would be in. But it happened about 3 years ago. My wife was driving home from Disneyland with my one-year-old son, and it was, you know, at night, and she called me from the car with, you know, from the Bluetooth, and she said, "What's that crazy way that you go?" Because there's sort of one conventional way to go that takes you through downtown L.A., and it's a traffic nightmare, and then there's a kind of a sneaky way I go, but it takes like 6 or 7 different freeways, and she had no idea what that route was. So she said, "Can you, you know, tell me which way it is?" And I said, "You know, why don't I just stay on the phone with you for the first 20 minutes and walk you through each step of the way?" And I'm at home, and I'm thinking about my son in the back of the car and the 6 lanes on the freeways and the merging and how crazy the freeways can get. And I'm already a little nervous talking to her. And then my son starts cranking out in the back seat of the car, and he won't stop. And, you know, it's a helpless feeling as a parent. If you're in the front seat of the car, what can you do? You know, you can't reach back. You can't turn around. There's nothing you can do. And he's 18 months old. And it goes on and on. I can feel my wife getting more and more frantic and nervous. She doesn't see that well at night with, you know, with her, she has, you know, glasses. And finally she says, I think I'm just going to pull over, you know, and deal with him. And I said, pull over. And, you know, and she said, "I'm going to pull off the freeway. Pull off the freeway." But, you know, because I'm walking her through it and talking to her, I roughly know where she's getting off.
Okay.
So she says, "I'll call you back in 5 minutes." So she hangs up the phone. And 2 minutes go by, and my mind just starts racing. You know, she's getting off the freeway exit at night. Who knows what's even there at that exit? And, you know, is it deserted? What's going on? And, of course, you know, all of my thousands of hours of working on Without a Trace kick in, and I start thinking about all the things that could happen to her. They get kidnapped, God knows what. And then I go to the next step of, I wonder how long it would take if she didn't call me back for me to jump in the car and go chase her to where I know, you know, approximately where she got off the road, because I kind of know within two or three exits basically where she got off. And another minute or two goes by, and I'm getting more and more nervous. Eventually she calls me back, and she says everything's fine, and they're back on the freeway, and everything worked out fine. But in those 4 minutes that she didn't call me back, this idea was unleashed for the beginning of some story where the husband is talking to the wife, she pulls off the road in similar circumstances, the husband goes, waits, you know, half hour, 40 minutes, maybe he calls local hospitals and he doesn't get it through anywhere, he just says, "Screw it, I'm getting in my car and I'm going there." And, you know, a frantic, you know, chase to sort of get off various freeway exits and looking around at gas stations and just building and building and building. And I just thought that's a really cool opening. I don't even know what happens when he finds the car, or does he not find the car. And I eventually settled in on the idea that he finds the car and his wife is gone, but the kids are in the car. I extrapolated instead of making it an 18-month-old kid. I made them be two kids, and they're older. They're a little bit older. They're like 6 and 3, which meant that they were just old enough to be able to tell the dad fragments of what had happened and why their mom went missing. And so I knew that was like a really great hook to something. And I started thinking about it and talking to my agent and my manager. And my manager said, you know, why don't you try writing a book? And I said, that might be an interesting idea, you know, and I'd always wanted to do it. I had a funny feeling that, you know, just selling it as a movie would be difficult. And I just was sort of in between projects, and I just started writing. And I wrote the first 50 pages, and I showed them to my agent, my manager, and they said, this is great. And the next thing you know, I was writing away, and you know, it unfurled into, you know, what it starts with this small domestic story about, you know, this husband, this wife, she goes missing, he doesn't know why. And then it evolved into that she's doing something completely secret that he knows nothing about, that she's been lying to him about things for a year, that there's fissures in their marriage, and now she's missing and she's got caught up in something very big, international in scope, and then he's got to go rescue her, but he's got to go rescue her in spite of the fact that she's been lying to him. So his quest to find her is also a quest to find out the answers to what she's been keeping from him, and kind of in a way, you know, to repair their marriage, to figure out what, you know, where has he gone wrong? How did he push her to do these things that she's been doing in secret from him? And that was what attracted me to the whole idea, was the, you know, having a really character driven story with the intricacies of a marriage, and then put it onto, you know, a story with a huge amount of scope. That would really, you know, open things up, and so I sort of thought of it as a, you know, a blend between, you know, Coben and, you know, and John le Carré. I mean, you know, if I could even aspire to be at that level, but so that's, you know, that's where I found myself, and it was a very different process writing a book than writing a screenplay. But you know, very, very much. Much harder in a lot of ways. I mean, liberating in a lot of ways, because in a screenplay for a TV or film, you're writing a scene and you've got to kind of keep the dialogue to, it's basically two pages, because, you know, an audience won't sit still for a scene that goes on much longer than that, and you don't have access to the internal monologues of your main characters, and you don't have, you know, you have to relay exposition in a much more naked way. In a TV show or a movie, and because it has to be usually it has to be verbalized in some way, and then you've got to figure out how to make your characters convey information to the audience in a way that doesn't feel unnatural. So, you know, writing the book was very liberating, you know, and also, you know, the attention to detail that you need to have, that you just don't need to have in a script, because, you know, a script is really a blueprint that's going to be interpreted by a director and actors and a cinematographer and a production designer, and in television, you know, you're going to be part of that as a producer. So, but you still don't write it in that much detail. You then, you know, you finish a TV script and you huddle together with your team, and you just have a conversation with a production designer about, this is what I'm thinking, and now you interpret it and do your great work. And it, you know, TV and film is such a collaborative medium, and writing a novel is so solitary. But what's fun about it is that, you know, that whatever you're doing there, that's the end product, and that it's a kind of much purer form, because whatever is there, that's what's going to be put out into the world. And I found that I had this sort of imaginary communion with the reader, that was sort of in the room with me, you know, invisible mm-hmm. and ephemeral, but kind of there. And so you're sort of imagining, how's the reader going to receive this? And it was a pretty fascinating process, and very gratifying.
Yeah, because
now that it's done.
When you're writing for a TV show, you have the ability to bring characters along kind of gradually, kind of what makes them up. You know, you're able to put things, you know, 5, 10, 15 episodes down the line and bring little things in. But when you're writing a book, you got to kind of bring the characters to the forefront right away. People got to kind of connect with them immediately, and you don't have that ability to kind of string out who they are and let people slowly kind of, you know, kind of get to know who they are. That was probably had to be a little bit daunting too, because things were just a lot more compact than a little bit more spread out, because you only have, you know, what, 350 pages that you're doing in a book. Aside from, you know, 27 episodes or how many episodes, 50 episodes and years that you have with the show.
That's very true. I mean, I have the advantage of having written in film and TV, which are, you know, so different. So basically, you know, I kind of relied on my film writing hat to kind of get into that mode, because, you know, in a screenplay for a film, you're trying to accomplish the same thing you are in a novel, which is get to things very quickly, introduce your character very quickly, convey who he is very quickly, what his problem is, what his issues are. And you know, I think that the book reads in a filmic way, in the best sense, you know, that it's paced in that way, which is, you know, appropriate for a thriller like this. You know, if it was a literary novel, it would be a different
right.
matter. But I think, you know, the skill set that I had developed in writing screenplays for film, you know, very much came into play here. And you know, so because I'm used to writing shorter scenes and having plot turns, I think that helps, you know, in this genre of writing where you tend to have shorter chapters and you're trying to, you know, cliffhang at the end of each chapter, if not with some outrageous plot turn, but at least cliffhang on an emotional beat. So I think that the skill sets I'd acquired from film writing were helpful. Television writing is, you know, a completely other matter, which is a much slower burn.
And I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author and creator, writer, of course, of the show, Without a Trace, but this is his debut book called Out of Range. Go to Amazon and search for it because, you know, since Hank is new here to the publishing, we're getting all the website and all the social media thing that all the authors now almost have to have in order to try to reach readers. So go to Amazon, you know, search Out of Range or Hank Steinberg, and you'll find the book available on Kindle. But you said the print, I think, comes out like June 4th. So people can, you know, find it all then. The other thing is that, you know, your character, Charlie Davis, and this is kind of how you ramped it all into, like, the worldwide thing, was because, you know, they're in Uzbekistan, and, you know, 6 years, and he's a journalist, and they kind of got out of their assignment and everything, and then they kind of bring it 6 years later into this whole, you know, world. So that's kind of what you meant by when you made everything worldwide. You wanted it to be, you know, more of an international kind of, you know, kind of intrigue instead of just a straight set, you know, cat and mouse game just set here in LA back and forth. How difficult, though, is it when you're trying to make everything worldwide to wrap all that up in 350? Because that's a daunting task for even for someone with your capabilities to do as a debut novel.
Well, you know, it's interesting how, I mean, I think every story probably is constructed differently. In this case, I came upon the idea with a hook of that, you know, that inciting incident of wife coming home from Disneyland and husband goes to chase her and she's gone and there's a big secret. And then I thought that's a great hook. And then I thought to myself, she's got to be doing something big, you know, something big, something international, something secret. She's, you know, working with MI6, and she's got herself in over her head. And how am I going to make that seem like a great spine to the story, but how am I going to make that fit with the characters? How am I going to make that organic with the characters? And sometimes you start with the characters, and sometimes you start with a situation, and you retrofit things in and find a way to make that it all feel organic, and that's definitely a skill set that you get from working in TV and film, I think, where sometimes you start with a concept and come and back your way into the character and it's all got to fit. So that's how I decided to construct these characters of how can I make these characters feel like they're in over their heads and underdogs, but not make it ridiculous, not make it seem like cartoonish. And
right.
So that's when I
Keep
came up with the idea.
With it.
Right, exactly. So that's when I came up with the idea to make Charlie Davis this, you know, international war correspondent who's been all over the world, who speaks multiple languages, who knows his way around, and to make his wife, Julie, this adventurer, do-gooder who had been working for NGOs in places in, you know, in third world countries. And so you get the idea that these people are adventurous in spirit to start with. And then, you know, I decided to come up with this prologue that starts them, you know, in Uzbekistan, where they get into a lot of trouble. And then it's, which is really a prologue, but it sets up who the characters are. And then we come forward 6 years later, they're now living a very domestic suburban life that everyone can relate to. So you have a combination of, I think, these really specific characters with skill sets that feel, oh, these people are really cool. I don't know anybody like this, but I'm curious about it. And then you end up with, but you also have the idea of, oh, they've traded in that life, and now they're living the suburban life. It's kind of like what I have. And I can kind of relate to the fact that, you know, he's got a desk job and she drives carpool, and they are kind of like me, but they have this past. And that's what I really like, the idea of playing with the different lives that people have and the choices that they make. And I think the metaphor there is, for all of us who were single, we're more adventurous, we're living more selfishly in certain ways, and then we alter our lives when we have children and we make certain concessions and we aren't living as adventurously, and maybe our world becomes smaller. And both of the characters miss that thing that they used to have when they were freer of spirit and they were out in the world accomplishing more. And so I think that's a conflict that people can hook into and relate to, is the family life that I've made versus maybe the grander ambitions I used to have before I made some of those concessions, and what happens if one person in that marriage gets restless and, you know, needs to go back out into that world again. And in this case, it has sort of Hitchcockian, you know, huge consequences. But in a way, it pulls them both back into something that they needed to satisfy in themselves, and I think that creates a dramatic inevitability that every story should have. So,
right.
That's, you know, kind of how it all came together.
Now, the one thing that you did mention, like at the beginning when you were talking about the book and your you know, conception of it, is you said that you knew that this would not play well into TV. How did you know that? A lot of authors, of course, their goal is to try to get, you know, into that realm right away. How did you know that that's something that would not work right off the bat?
It just felt like it's going to be its own self-contained story, that it had a largeness. The hook that I came up with, I thought, had a largeness to it, and I just had a feeling that it should be its own parable, and not become something longer reaching than that. And you know, I've been doing a lot of TV, and so I was yearning for that kind of storytelling anyway. It just was, you know, like I said, I started writing the book in between other projects, and just to see, can I do this? And you know, the 50 pages that I came up with, everybody was very excited about, and we were actually able to hook the publisher off of those 50 pages and a treatment. And that gave me the confidence to say, okay, you know, I can go forward and finish the book. And, you know, it was a real learning process, and I had a great editor, and, you know, it ended up working out great. And it's definitely one of the most satisfying creative experiences I've had. And, of course, it'll be more satisfying if people buy the book next week.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of how, you know, I mean, that's it. But you're putting yourself into a realm that you've never done before. You're now an author. You now have to be out into the public. You now have to talk with fans and do those things where, as before, you know, like your show Without a Trace, you know, the studio was the one that was promoting it on the TV and advertising it. You never really had to go out and do any of that. So how are you dealing with having to kind of get out from behind everything to now having to put yourself in the forefront?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, it's a sort of, I mean, I'm used to selling myself because, in Hollywood, you know, when you go to pitch a TV show or pitch a film, or you're up for a film job, you are sort of selling your wares. You know, you're going into a room and you're trying to convince people that you know what you're talking about and that your ideas are good. So I am used to talking about what I do, and hopefully, you know, convincing people that, you know, it's interesting. But of course,
but now you
got to
talk to the old lady that has 17 cats
that's looking to buy your book, and she's different than the guy at Fox with the suit.
Yes, there's no question about it. There's no question about it. No,
yeah.
But it's, you know, it's fun because you actually are very separated from your fans in TV and film. It's very, you know, I think probably the closest thing is to write a play where you can sit in the audience and watch people enjoy it. But you know, writing a book is probably the next best thing where you can, you know, potentially email with your fans and get out there at book signings and meet people and hear from people. And it's actually very satisfying because you get in a little bit of a bubble when you're just doing the TV and film thing. And you know, the best you might get is at a premiere where people are kissing your tushy, but you're not even sure if it's real. So, you know, no, it's been fun.
So this is something that you are going to continue. Do you already have, you know, your next book kind of planned? Is this the realm that you want to, are you going to try to hop between both, you know, the Hollywood side and the publishing side now going forward with your career?
Yes, I will be hopping between both. I have a TV series that is just starting that's going to be on TNT next summer called The Last Ship. I just started with the writers this week in the writers' room, but I do have the second book coming out next year, and it will be another installment in the character of Charlie Davis. I do have the storyline pretty well worked out at this point, and I'm starting to get into it. So if only there were more hours in the day, but somehow
exactly.
I have to manage it.
Yeah, I mean, even though we have all this technology, guess what? There's still only 24 hours in a day, and that's the one thing. Now there's more crap that we need to worry about, but we still got the same amount of time. Things used to be a lot simpler, you know, 20 years ago, but not anymore today. Jesus, the weed, everything's going so fast.
They've actually done studies about it and have figured out that the technology does not make anyone operate more efficiently. Ironically, we're all like emailing with all this frequency, but nothing gets done particularly faster. And if you've ever had a six or seven email exchange with a person where you're just trying to get a simple answer to a question, you realize it would have been so much easier to just pick up the phone because we're completely missing each other. You know, that's the world we live in, so, you know, we got to work with it.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Hank. I mean, so the show you have on TNT is called The Last Ship?
Yeah, it won't be on until the summer of 2014.
Right.
It's a big, doing it with Michael Bay, who shot some of the pilot, and big action-adventure show on the high seas with starring Eric Dane and Rhona Mitra. It should be really fun.
And that'll coincide kind of with your next book coming out, because your next book will probably be out sometime around May, right?
We're shooting between May, either that May cycle again or possibly December, depending on how long it takes, given how busy I am.
Right. Well, that's fabulous. Hey, well, we wish you nothing but the best. You know, the book is out of range. Like I said, go to Amazon or go to BarnesandNoble.com, search for Out of Range, Hank Steinberg, find the book, and, hey, let us know, you know, when you got things up, give us your news, and we like to keep everybody updated on, you know, what you're doing and seeing if we can have you all maybe back in another year when your next book comes out. If you want to come on and talk about anything else you got going on TV, movie-wise, hey, just let us know. We're here.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me.
All right, Hank, you have a good day. We'll talk to you soon. Enjoy the weather.
Thank you, too.
We're actually going to go to that Hollywood movie thing tonight I'm being dragged to for Some Like It Hot, so that'll be interesting.
Oh, well, that'll be fun.
That'll be good, so we'll see.
All right,
enjoy the summer.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Take care.
All right, bye, Hank. So again, everybody, that was Hank Steinberg, and the book is called Out of Range. It's his debut novel, but he is not anywhere near debut with the creation of course, Without a Trace, the show that was worldwide phenomenon, and now you get that same type of writing with this book, Out of Range. And again, go to Amazon, go to Barnes & Noble, search for it, Hank Steinberg, Out of Range, pick it up. The Kindle's available now. You can get the hardcover, I believe he said June 4th. So it's a great time for readers right now with the summer stuff coming out, that you have no excuses at all that you can't read a freaking book, because there's hundreds of them coming out. I mean, we are bombarded with new novels. And just the three authors that we had on today, will occupy a lot of your time in a very, very positive way. And we want to thank James Tabor for being on and talking about Frozen Solid. And that's James M. Tabor, TABOR.com. Again, David Morrell talking about murder as a fine art. And you can go to davidmorrell.net for more information there. And Hank Steinberg, that was just on here. We got a lot of shows coming. We got some time missing. I'm going to be traveling a little bit. Then we got Thriller Fest here in July. But I waited to the end of the show to kind of let you guys know what's going on here. And in November, we are going to have exclusively here on Suspense Radio, James Patterson will be joining us in the magazine and on the show live. Don't miss out on hearing him with his newest book, Talk My Heart. Check out SuspenseMagazine.com. Click on the radio button. You can coach up Steve Barry, Marcia Clark, Paul Parsons, Taylor Cool is all going to be on the next show, June 29th. Until then, we will see you all. If you're a Thriller Fest, come up and say hello to us. Bye, everybody.